So hello, everyone, whether you're in the U.S., Israel, Palestine, or elsewhere. This is an installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel, a series of informational webinars designed to provide a careful, in-depth examination of a variety of topics central to the Israel-Palestine conflict. My name is Todd Gitlin, and for the next 60 minutes, I'll moderate. I'm a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. I'm a member of the PPI board, and I will be referring you to our participants. Let me note first that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit 501c3 organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen American Jews' understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance their ability to advocate progressive Israeli futures. Let me now introduce our two panelists. Laura Friedman is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, previously was director of policy and government relations at American Now, and before that, a foreign service officer in Jerusalem, Beirut, Tunis, and elsewhere. Jeremy Ben-Ami held positions in Bill Clinton's White House and Howard Dean's presidential campaign, as well as the New Israel Fund. He is the president of J Street. So here's how we'll do this. We're gonna talk for about 40 minutes, and then we will be answering questions from the video audience, whether by computer or via Facebook. You can type in your questions at any time. I'm told that at the bottom of your monitor, there will be an icon that reads Q&A, which you may need to touch on your screen or run your mouse over. Then you click on the icon and you type your question in the box. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted. Your viewer microphones will be turned off, and questions can only be asked when typed in this way. No questions over the phone, I'm afraid. So with no further ado, here we go. I want to ask Laura to start by giving us a summary of some of the so-called anti-BDS legislation that's cropped up both on the state level and in Congress. Laura, over to you. Sure.
Thank you. And I want to say thank you so much, Partners for Progressive Israel, for having us here and having me here today to talk about this timely issue. I don't want to overwhelm people with details, so I'll try to be somewhat telegraphic. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we have seen a sort of burst of legislation related to BDS. And when I say related to BDS, I want to be clear. A lot of this legislation, if not most of it, in terms of what it actually seeks to do, is more about conflating boycotts of Israel with boycotts of settlements and seeking to stop the second. And we can talk more about that if you want to later. But it sort of hones in on a problem here, because sometimes when we're talking about this, we're talking about the free speech piece of it, and sometimes we're talking about the conflation and support of settlements piece of it. And these are two problems that coexist, but they're different. The legislation really started in earnest end of 2015, after the EU adopted its differentiation policy, which was its policy, which said that this is Israel, this is settlements, we support Israel, and we will do everything we can to expand trade with Israel, yada, 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 but settlements are not part of Israel, against international law, and everyone should differentiate in their treatment of Israel and settlements. We immediately started to see legislation introduced. We saw it at the state level, and everyone is sort of, I think, mostly is aware of this now because it's finally gotten attention. But over the past 4 years, I think it's a total now of 26 states. Don't quote me on that number. I've got a table online which you can reference. I think 26 states have adopted legislation that, in effect, seeks to sanction those who boycott Israel or settlements. Virtually all of this legislation specifically says, for the purposes of the law, boycotting Israel includes boycotting settlements. The laws that don't say that are being implemented, as far as I know, to treat it as if it's the same thing. So the way states do this is one kind of legislation says we will divest from companies, our pension funds, whatever, we'll divest from companies that boycott Israel or settlements. And there you get the odd thing of like Airbnb. You've got now the possibility of divestment from Airbnb, which is actively working across Israel, but doesn't work in settlements. But now it's going to be on blacklists as a boycotter of settlements of Israel, which is odd. So that's one kind. The other kind is the kind that has been in the courts, which is the kind that says you cannot enjoy the benefit of a state contract as a business, as an individual contractor, unless you sign away your right to boycott Israel or settlements, which is almost a textbook definition of an unconstitutional condition. In effect, you're giving up your constitutional right to compete for these things in order to be able to compete. That's not allowed. So that's been in court. That's at the state level. At the federal level, we have legislation, and the first round of this was actually announced at the AIPAC policy conference in 2015 by Senator Cardin, where we had, including on the progressive left, this years of drumbeat about BDS is the existential threat to Israel that we all need to worry about. And it was a very short distance from that to, well, this is something we have to legislate against. And it wasn't at the time, I think, understood to be controversial, except maybe on the issue of conflating Israel and settlements. So we ended up with what are now two pieces of legislation, which have been introduced over and over. They've been featured in, this is the first, we had two policy conferences of AIPAC that featured the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, one which also featured the Combating BDS Act, and now we've got a resolution. And those two pieces of legislation do different and equally problematic things. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act seeks to effectively criminalize U.S. Businesses boycotting Israel or settlements. And it argues that the backers of this bill say this is nothing new. This is just an extension of the anti-boycott legislation of the 70s. You know, BDS is the new Arab League boycott of Israel. What that ignores is the fact that the Arab League boycott of Israel was what is called a coercive boycott, right? A secondary boycott, where the Arab League said, we boycott Israel and you can't do business with us unless you also boycott Israel. Legislation was written back in the 70s to prevent American companies from being forced to join the Arab League army, compelled in order to do business against Israel. Well, BDS isn't coercive. BDS is a choice. On top of that, the legislation that is pending in Congress, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, it hasn't been reintroduced yet this year, but it certainly will be, actually is aimed at settlements squarely. It's called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, but what it actually seeks to do is say that U.S. companies will be committing a crime. Initially, it was punishable up to 20 years in jail, and I think it's $20 million in fines, and now it's just the fines, not the jail. But you're committing a crime if you choose, and this is a political choice, to differentiate between Israel and settlements along the lines of what the EU does. It specifies the EU, or it says along the lines of the UN database, which people call a blacklist. It's not a blacklist. It hasn't been published. But when it is, it has there's nothing that compels anyone to do anything, right? If you're very pro-settler, you could use that list and say, this is my guide of where I want to shop. But this law will say that if you use that as a guide of I don't want to do business because I oppose settlements, you will be breaking U.S. law. And the other piece of legislation is the Combating BDS Act, which is legislation that was attached to the first thing they did in the Senate this year. It passed by the Senate, very controversial. And that is essentially an effort by Congress to give political cover and in a sense, a green light and incentivize to states to pass the laws that two federal courts have already found to be unconstitutional. Those are the ones we talked about first. So that's pretty much the lay of the land. Where we are today, by the way, in the current policy conference, AIPAC has, in my view, made a tactical shift, not a retreat, but a tactical shift, and is pushing for a very broad anti-BDS non-binding resolution. And basically saying to people, well, you can't complain that it hurts free speech, it's non-binding. But once this non-binding resolution is passed with a very, very large majority on both sides, it will then be a hook to say, well, if you think BDS is so bad, you're a hypocrite if you won't support binding resolution, binding legislation to stop it. And also to say that any member of Congress who supports BDS, any candidate who supports BDS, or as supporters who support BDS, which we saw in the last election cycle, that all of those people are radioactive. So that is what is being set up today in Congress.
Thank you, Laura. I just want to intrude with a reminder to people who are tuned in to write questions, and which we'll get to once we proceed a little further. The questions will remain. Just one more question for you, Laura, before I turn to Jeremy. What's the politics of this? Who's promoting these measures and who's opposing them? Where do we stand?
So the politics are interesting. Starting at the federal level, so a lot of folks are seeing this as purely sort of a partisan Trump era thing. I think it's really important to note that this started under Obama. The legislation, which was essentially the gateway drug to this addiction, was passed under Obama. It was two pieces of major trade legislation, one called the TPA bill, Trade Promotion Act, and the other one, the Customs bill. These were two signature pieces that Obama wanted. And Senator Cardin, Senator Portman, AIPAC, and others got into that legislation language, which said, for the purposes of U.S. trade negotiations, it is a top priority to get our trade partners to not discriminate against Israel, which includes boycotts or special trade restrictions. And in that legislation, it explicitly defined boycotts of Israel, trade restrictions of Israel, as applying to Israel and territories under Israel's control. That became law twice under Obama, bipartisan. Cardin first introduced the IABA, Israel Anti-Boycott Act, under Obama. So this has been something that's building for a while. It obviously is becoming very partisan now. The desire from folks either on the very, what they would say, they consider themselves very pro-Israel, I would just say pro-Israeli right of the progressives, the Democrats, or on the Republican side, sensing an opportunity. BDS is now seen as, I would argue, the richest vein that can be mined politically to fracture progressive unity and to undermine Democratic candidates. And you know, so far, I would say they're not wrong. That's what we're seeing. And until progressives come up with an answer for that, I think they're just going to continue to hemorrhage.
Thank you. I want to turn to Jeremy now, pursuing that line of discussion. So, Jeremy, as you look around the country, are you seeing the BDS coming up in our national politics and local politics, election campaigns, run-ups to election campaigns? Are constituents chiming in on this one way or the other? What do you see?
Well, definitely, BDS itself has become an extraordinarily political issue. You know, what's so fascinating is that the actual boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is having practically no impact whatsoever on the actual situation in Israel or the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And, you know, when you go to Israel and you experience the vibrant economy and all of the growth that's going on, you realize that this movement has had zero actual impact there. But here, it is front and center in the politics of the moment. And it's almost as if you're living in another universe, you know, that this is so front and center and fracturing American politics, as Lara said, when the real discussion that needs to be had by those of us who care about Israel is about the occupation and is about how to end the occupation and about what policies, you know, are good for the United States. And we're sort of being distracted away from that by having an argument about BDS. And so, yes, it is a very big political issue, but it is not a very relevant one, I believe, to the actual content of the work that matters to groups like J Street, PPI, the Foundation for Middle East Peace, because we actually are trying to work towards a resolution of the conflict and towards finding a way out of occupation, and we're spending all our time talking about BDS.
So would you say there's a distraction going on? Who are the distractors?
Well, I think it plays to the hands of both sides of the polls of the debate. I think for a lot of the more conservative politically organizations, it's very, very helpful to have some form of a adversary or an enemy or something to be working against. And the BDS movement is a very useful tool and a useful foil for defense organizations that raise money and put together large conferences and gather people to defend Israel from attack. So building up the BDS movement is a useful tool for organizations on the right. And of course, for organizations on the left, it's a very, very useful way to get a conversation started about these issues in the United States, particularly if you then get attacked, as the right wing is doing to the BDS movement, and your civil liberties are under attack. Then liberals say, well, wait a minute, why are these anti-free speech right wingers attacking people who just want to use boycotts to end oppression? Isn't that what we did with South Africa? Isn't that what we did in the South to defeat Jim Crow? And suddenly you have a whole influx of support for the BDS movement from well-meaning liberals who don't really understand what was the BDS charter and what are the fundamental principles on which it was founded. And so it's really in the interest of both the left and the right to have the argument be about BDS. And it, you know, I think they're both just feeding off each other, unfortunately.
So you raised the analogy to South Africa, or that is to say, you noted that some people say, well, it was right to do this boycott with respect to South Africa, but not here. But what's the difference?
Well, I think that one of the key differences is, you know, what we're pointing to with this differentiation issue. You know, when people are boycotting against an entire regime, as in South Africa, and you know, going after the entirety of the system, that is different from the question here, which is what is Israel itself doing in the territories? And Israel is a functioning democracy. Now, it's imperfect, like so many democracies, including our own, but it is a different problem. You have a military occupation of territory won in a war, and you have the subjugation of a set of people who lived in that territory to military rule for 50 years. That's a different problem than there was in South Africa. And also the economies and the economic situation are completely different. And the tactical choices that are available for the BDS movement are not able to bring the kind of pressure on the Israeli economy that would actually bring them to start thinking about different policies. So it's tactically inefficient. It's a different system. You know, it's just not a comparable situation.
You think it would be fair to say that the BDS movement is a case of symbolic politics?
Well, it's symbolic, but I think it's really important to note what the BDS movement actually is calling for. You know, for a group like J-String, for a person like me, I believe very, very deeply in the right of the Jewish people to a national homeland in the land of Israel, right? I'm a Zionist. I believe in that at my core. The BDS movement doesn't acknowledge the right of the Jewish people to be free in their own land. It recognizes the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people, but not of the Jewish people. And so I think that this is really important to introduce into the conversation, that when people are engaging in the BDS movement as a way of trying to make some of their policy unhappiness known about what's going on with settlements or what is going on with you know, the occupation more broadly, they're buying into a movement that is driven by a charter and a set of principles that does not recognize Israel's right to exist, that is not interested in a two-state solution, and that doesn't make the differentiation that Lara is talking about, which you know, is so important between the justice of the state of Israel's existence with all its imperfection and the injustice of the occupation that happens over the Green Line. And so, you know, what does happen is the notion that boycotts sound like they were effective in other places, so why not try it here, is attractive to critics of Israeli policy, and people buy in then to a movement that actually most likely they wouldn't agree with a lot of its underlying principles.
I think it's interesting to note that when, during all the years of apartheid, the African National Congress position was always that South Africa was a unitary state. And what they meant by that was that it was not legitimate to carve out certain territories within the territory of South Africa and say, well, those are independent Bantustans, which was a fraudulent claim in the first place. So the ANC and the rulers could agree, at least, on the nature of the state of South Africa. The question was whether it was to be a democratic state, whether it was, and who, what its rules ought to be. One more question about the local reactions, Jeremy. Not so long ago, the Boston Jewish Community Relations Council passed a resolution declaring that any of its member organizations supporting the BDS movement could be expelled. How prevalent do you find this kind of effort to control who gets to count as a Jewish organization?
This is very prevalent, and that exact conversation is going on all over the country. Now, sometimes it's in a Jewish Community Relations Council and at the city level, sometimes it might be on a college campus with regard to a Hillel and who's welcome at the Hillel. Sometimes synagogues have arguments over, you know, who can be brought in as a speaker and whether a rabbi's politics on something are acceptable and their contract deserves to be renewed. So over and over again, Jewish film festivals, book festivals, all the rest of it, there's a constant debate about what are the particular viewpoints that put someone outside the tent. I think this is extraordinarily dangerous. The Jewish community is a very wide-ranging community. There are folks on the right who are, you know, absolutely, to my mind, off the chart in terms of their viewpoints. And you know, some of them are now, in fact, running for the Knesset and follow Mayor Kahana and talk about expulsion of Arabs from the state of Israel. And then there's folks all the way on the left who are anti-Zionist and believe that the concept of Israel was a mistake, but they're all Jews. And as a vibrant, healthy Jewish community, we need to recognize that as repulsive as we might find some of the views on one end of that argument or the other, and anywhere in between, our community will be a lot stronger if we find a way to have a healthy conversation and a healthy debate and a robust debate that keeps all of those people in the Jewish communal tent, as opposed to beginning to have litmus tests based on people's views. Where you see that lead is what I think you saw a lot at the, unfortunately, at the AIPAC conference this week, which is this notion that if, let's say, you start to be critical of Israeli policy, not only are you not welcome in, the tent, but you then are labeled as anti-Israel because you disagree on a matter of policy with the government of Israel, you're called anti-Israel. And then it's not a long road from being anti-Israel to then being anti-Semitic. And you saw it just with President Trump, who in, you know, the course of 60 seconds started talking about how the Democrats are, you know, wrong on Israel, then they are anti-Israel. And then by the end of his remarks, he was already calling the Democratic Party anti-Jewish. And these are broad brushes that I think it's a huge mistake for our own Jewish communal leadership and institutions to buy into, sort of conflating people who are highly critical of what's going on in Israel with those who are anti-Israel or even anti-Semitic.
Jeremy, I'm sure you don't mean to suggest that the President of the United States is ill-informed about what constitutes being anti-Jewish.
No, not just about what's being anti-Jewish, just generally.
Okay. Question for both of you, Jeremy and Laura. Should pro-Israel, pro-peace American Jews cooperate with the American Jewish establishment when it combats BDS in the public opinion realm? What should our relation be with them, as it were?
So, Laura? I don't even know what that means. I don't fully understand the question. I can answer it, I guess, use it as a platform to say that what I think is important to say. I think the American Jewish community has done an enormous disservice to itself, to the cause of peace, to progressive values, by allowing itself to be co-opted into becoming the tip of the spear in an attack on U.S. civil liberties. I think it's appalling. I mean, and for me as an American Jew raised in the kind of Jewish home where it was explained to me why Jews, because of our experience in the world, recognize that you have to protect all free speech because it's the most vulnerable who suffer. We know this. If it's not protected for everyone, it's protected for nobody. The idea that American progressives are getting on board in the name of fighting BDS, which whether you like it or not, it is legitimate, it is legal, it is nonviolent. And I have to say, my experience in this country is that most people are not signing on to the BDS movement in every checking the boxes, I agree. But what they're saying is, I have lost all hope of anything I'm doing influencing this Israeli government. This seems like at least a way I can vote with my feet, vote with my wallet, and take a stand. And frankly, for people who want to push back against BDS, it is, you know, I have been, you know, from when I was at Peace Now to now, I don't personally advocate boycotting Israel, but I will start with the recognition that it is an arbitrary and manufactured distinction between calling for a boycott of Israel and a boycott of settlements. The settlements are a product of the Israeli government. They are supported by Israeli policy. They are funded by the Israeli taxpayer. It is an arbitrary distinction, and it's a distinction which I encourage people to make because I think it's a more effective tactic if your goal is not simply to vent your spleen and show your anger and not achieve anything. If your goal is to change Israeli policy from the, I would say, hysterical reaction of the Israeli government to pressure on settlements, I would say pressure on settlements is meaningful and more effective than giving them the, oh, this is just anti-Israel, we're going to ignore it. But I think it's an entirely manufactured argument. I will say, though, the durability within the progressive Jewish community now of this idea that whatever else happens, we must circle the wagons, at least we can all stand together under the comfortable tent of we think BDS is bad. If progressives do not understand that they are signing on to an anti-progressive agenda, both on Israel and more broadly on U.S. civil liberties, you know, it's almost too late already. And I don't know what it will require for them to realize it. We have a Jewish owner of a newspaper in Arkansas whose newspaper may go bankrupt because he's taking a stand and refusing to sign on the dotted line that he will not ever boycott Israel, boycott settlements as a condition for doing business with the state. And that has led to all sorts of backlash, and it's in court. At what point do we stand up and say this is an abuse of concern for Israel? This isn't concern for Israel. You know, this is concern for settlements, for greater Israel, for an illiberal agenda which says political free speech that's critical of things we don't like, we want to ban it. That's not the Jewish progressive values I was raised with.
Can we talk a bit more about what the Israeli government is doing vis-a-vis these initiatives in the U.S., in the states and in the federal government? To what extent do you see these initiatives drawing inspiration from Israel's own anti-boycott law? Is the Israeli government, to your knowledge, directly involved in promoting these sorts of legislative initiatives?
Is that for me?
For either of you.
I mean, I'll weigh in and say, as soon as someone can find the smoking gun that demonstrates Israeli government direct involvement, that'll be a great article in the New York Times or something. I think the Israeli government is very open. I mean, the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs has an agenda to engage in the international community to fight BDS, to pass legislation. They're very public about this. There's no shame. And if you watch the video that everyone's supposed to not watch of the undercover reporting on the various Jewish right-wing organizations, you see people talking about it fairly openly. You know, whether or not they are actively injecting money into things, I don't think there's proof of that at this point. Don't know if it exists and if someone will find it.
Jeremy?
This is a very clear strategy, and it's a strategy that is emanating from the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. So hopefully it's a strategy since that's the ministry that's coming up with it. I mean, they are, I believe, building up the BDS movement in order to have a fight over taking it down. As I said in my opening remarks, this is a movement that's having zero actual impact on the world. It's having no impact at all on the ground in Israel. It is exerting no pressure at all on Israel's economy, on the settlements. In fact, wineries are happy on the West Bank to be on the list of settlement products, as Lara said, because then people know, you know, who want to support it, where to go, and where to buy. So this is not about the actual impact of the boycotts. It is about creating a fight over enemies of the state of Israel and turning people who are critics of its policies into anti-Israel boogie people. I couldn't agree with Lara more. I think that, you know, the progressive movement in buying into this, any progressives who do buy into it, I don't think a whole lot do, into engaging heavily on anti-BDS work, they're completely missing the point. Because if you want to be progressive and you want to be about Israel, let's not argue about BDS. Let's not argue on the arena stage that the folks who are perpetuating the settlement enterprise want to argue about. They want to argue about BDS. They want to argue about whether it's critics or anti-Semites. They want to deflect from what's actually happening on the West Bank. Are Palestinian villages being demolished, our lands being confiscated, are the settlements expanding? Is freedom of movement constrained? Is there undrinkable water in Gaza? Is there not enough power? These are the issues that people don't want to be discussing. So they'd rather be discussing whether or not, you know, Airbnb is anti-Israel or Ilhan Omar is anti-Semitic, but they don't want to be discussing what does it say about the Jewish people when the state of the Jewish people bulldozes Khan al-Ahmar. That is not what the Ministry of Strategic Affairs would like to be discussing. So its strategy is to make BDS the conversation and not the occupation. Progressives should make the conversation about the occupation, not about BDS.
It would be fair to say that there's a weird alliance between the Netanyahu government and the BDS movement?
Exactly. I mean, I also, you know, said that earlier, that I think the only people who have a real interest in this being the discussion are the folks on the far right who need something to distract people to argue about, and the people on the left who build up their movement in the BDS world around this argument. But it isn't actually doing anything to move us toward the end of the occupation or the end of the conflict. And those two, you know, ends of the spectrum, I think, have a real self-interest in making that the argument. But where I think, you know, our organizations are all at is we're trying to find other routes to move this conflict away from, you know, a deepened one state reality and back a little bit towards the chance of some form of partition separation into two states.
Can I just add something?
Go ahead, Laura.
One other point I just think is important. I think it's important to note the way this is playing. This is coming, this is reaching ahead at a moment. I'm going to use a word everyone is probably sick of hearing, which is intersectionality. We are reaching a moment on the progressive side of the political spectrum when you have a grassroots movement, which between Black Lives Matter and related things is saying, we will not tolerate progressive except on blank. We're going to ask people to have the courage of their convictions across the board, and we're going to call you a hypocrite if you don't. And what's happening with the way BDS is being weaponized is, you know, you look at the progressive base, the progressive political base, and you look at the progressive candidates out there, and this is being weaponized to enormous effect against Black and brown candidates, Black and brown members of Congress. People say to me, how did this play in the last election cycle? It's amazing to me how few people know that Stacey Abrams, in her primary campaign, she was up against another House member, very progressive woman, wonderful, two very good candidates, one a Jewish American, one a Black American. And the issue that was used in that primary to differentiate between them and to attack Stacey Abrams was BDS. Not because she supports BDS, but because she voted against one of these state laws because of the free speech issue. And, you know, we were forced to watch the spectacle of this remarkable candidate, who is a remarkable future leader of the Democratic Party, perhaps. Watching her, she posted an article on Medium before the election, essentially laying out her, I love Israel bona fides, please, 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 don't hold it against me that I support free speech. And we saw this in Florida, where you had a really good candidate for governor there, who essentially was attacked, not because he supports BDS or is in any way inclined to saying he does, but because he's supported by Dream Defenders, which is a grassroots, vibrant movement which does support BDS. And it was argued that because he's supported by Dream Defenders, which is now being attacked by right-wing organizations who are saying that because of its support for BDS, it should be brought up on charges by the Department of Justice, either under RICO or forced to register under FARA, because of the support for BDS.
Explain RICO.
Racketeering. There's an organization out there which right now, it's got a couple of main goals, but one of its main goals is to get the Department of Justice to go after major BDS leaders and organizations that support it, saying that BDS is an illegal action because it is affiliated, they say, with people who support terror, and it's therefore constitutes material support for terror, and therefore organizations supporting it are calling for people to break US law, and now you're under racketeering charges. Much like there's RICO being used to go after the environmental organizations. My point is here, you're talking about two really good candidates, both of whom are African American, where BDS was the chosen tool to try to undermine them. And Jewish progressives, by not being able to stand up and say, listen, whether we support BDS or not, we will not allow this to happen. There has to be space here to disagree on this and to disagree legitimately This is peaceful. This is legal. This is a stand. This is something people have used. Boycotts and calling for boycotts is not new. The idea that it's okay on everything but Israel, if progressives are there, they are poisoning the well for candidates and very strongly for candidates who are black and brown. And that's unconscionable.
I think the good news, though, I want to just put out the good news, which is that when you look at the vote in the Senate on S1, and you look at the people who are thinking of running for president, that at the end of the day, first of all, the Democratic caucus split 50-50, and we were able to convince half of the Democrats to vote against this legislation, basically on these grounds. But of the people running for president, all but one voted against it. And the folks who are not in the Senate right now, many of them came out against it as well. And so I do think that the understanding that this is the wrong fight to be having and the right place to be as a Democrat, as a progressive on politics generally, is to support the right to boycott, even if you disagree with the principles of some of the elements of the movement. I do think we're winning on that fight in the progressive movement. I don't think there are a lot of progressives who fall into the category that are saying, yes, but, except for Palestine. I do think we are seeing movement, and I think we see it in the presidential field. I think that vote in S1, and I do think that the House resolution that's been introduced on BDS, which is the attempt to try to give a vote and a space for members of the House to go on record as opposing the movement, but not opposing the principle of the right to boycott, is also a victory in that the leadership was able to coalesce a majority of Democrats around that. So I do think that this fight is being won on that ground within the Democratic Party.
Good. Okay, so let's call a halt then to phase one. And we're into the segue moment to the Q&A. Some of you have already typed in questions. Let me remind you, if you're watching and you have a question, you can type it in. Look for the icon that reads Q&A at the bottom of your monitor, or you may need to touch your screen or run your mouse over it, and then click on the icon, type your question in. All your microphones will be turned off, and questions can only be asked when they're typed in this way, and we'll do our best to answer as many questions as possible. So with no further ado, we have 7 questions outstanding. The first one is from Andrea Beth Damsky, and it is, I think, to Laura. Can you clarify what conflating Israel and the settlements means?
Sure. So Israel is, when people talk, when in a technical term, when the UN refers to Israel or the US government, well, I don't know what Trump means, but until Trump referred to Israel, what they meant was Israel within what are recognized as its sovereign borders, which are delineated by the armistice line of 1949, right? So that is West Jerusalem and all of 1948 Israel. It doesn't include East Jerusalem. It doesn't include the settlements in the West Bank. It doesn't include the Golan Heights or Gaza or the Sinai for that matter. So that is Israel. And US policy, when it is historically talked about Israel in legislation or anywhere else, that's what it meant. What we are seeing, what we started seeing, again, towards the end of Obama with those two laws and now over and over, is language which explicitly defines, for the purposes of law, it defines Israel to mean Israel and territories under Israel's control, which is, first of all, a way of erasing the idea of occupation. Surprise, you know, occupation doesn't exist anymore. And second, it's really interesting. I mean, Israel has asserted its sovereignty over the Golan and East Jerusalem long ago. The world never recognized it, but it did exert its sovereignty. I mean, Israel applied its law, which is de facto annexation. Israel has never applied its law wholesale across the West Bank. It has never annexed it formally. So in effect, you have US laws that treat the West Bank as part of Israel where Israeli law doesn't. That's the conflation, where now you're saying Israel and the settlements are indistinguishable. They are one and the same. And this is important because if you accept that conflation, then when someone says to you today, well, Airbnb boycotts Israel, then that makes sense to you, because if you're boycotting settlements, it doesn't matter if you're operating in all of sovereign Israel and everything, you know, you're in every city in sovereign Israel. If you're not in the settlements, under this definition, you're boycotting Israel. And it's been very effective.
Thank you. Next question is from Laura Lieben, and it's to Jeremy. Why are you and J Street against BDS in the occupied territories?
So it turns out, I think that there's a number of questions in the chain about this issue, and particularly about J Street's position. So I'll answer it once, but I don't want to, you know, take too much of the time of this conversation on that. J Street has a position on BDS, which is on our website. If you go to our website and click under policy, you'll find our full position on BDS. We have three principal problems with boycott, divestment, sanction initiatives generally. Number one is the failure of those movements, proposals, initiatives, activists to recognize Israel's right to exist. So we will oppose anybody who doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. We recognize the right of the Palestinian people to a state. We expect Palestinian activists to recognize the right of the Jewish people to a state. So that's number one. Number two, we are a pro-two-state organization. We believe that that is the only way to resolve the underlying conflict that we actually should be discussing. Instead of discussing BDS, we need to discuss the conflict and how we resolve it. And we support a two-state solution. So if people are not supporting a two-state solution and want to see one state, and they want to see it be, for instance, a state for all its citizens, which is a very nice ideal, and I'm not opposed to democracy and I'm not opposed to universal rights, but let's recognize that if you have 13 million people between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea and you give everybody rights, it's no longer going to be the state of the Jewish people. So I am personally not in favor of one state, and I want to see a two-state solution so the Jewish people have a state and the Palestinian people have a state. So if you're not in favor of two states, but you're in favor of one, then we will oppose that. And the third is this issue that Laura just raised, which is that we, as J Street, as an organization, do draw this distinction along the green line between the territory that is the state of Israel and the territory that is controlled by the state of Israel, that is not under Israeli law, that is under military occupation, that is under Israeli military rule. And there is a distinction. And if your initiative and your proposal and your boycott and all the rest of it draws no distinction between the two, then we will oppose that. So our position is we will oppose the movement because the principles that it holds do not comport with our principles. And we will not support any initiative that doesn't meet those three tests. But then again, we're not going to support any boycott. This is not a useful conversation, in our opinion. We're just not going to oppose settlement boycotts. If people are pro-Israel, pro-two states, and engaging in settlement boycotts, more power to you. It's your right, as Laura said, it's a free country. It's a constitutionally protected right to go do it. It doesn't mean that J Street has to endorse it and support it, but we're certainly not going to oppose it.
Related, Leon Fink asked, would J Street support BDS-style boycott / divestment if it was more carefully tailored to the occupation and buttressed by reaffirmation of the right of a Jewish homeland?
Right. My hope was to answer all of those BDS questions about J Street with my answer. You know, the answer, I hope, is clearly no. We're not going to support any initiative along those lines. The question is, what will we not oppose? And I think I answered that, and it's on our website.
Okay, but let me append another specific question, which I think is sound, again, for you. It's a statement. Sometimes we take a stand because it's practical, but there are times when one takes a stand that is morally or ethically based. It is not bearable to me to ignore the attack on American civil liberties. It is not a matter of singling out BDS as the best way to pressure Israel to change its occupation of the West Bank. None of the methods that have been used so far affected Israeli policy. BDS is one method we can use. And I would add to that, Jeremy, you said before about taking other roads or other routes, and maybe you could speak to that here.
Well, I mean, I just want to be clear to Stephen and about J Street's position. We oppose any legislation that attempts to penalize or criminalize boycotts and say, even if we disagree with the movement, and even if we disagree with the initiative, we are opposed to legislation that would single out BDS and that would in fact be an attack on American civil liberties. That's why we opposed S1. It's why we opposed the Anti-Boycott Act. It's why we opposed the Combating BDS Act. You know, we do agree on that. It doesn't mean that we support the BDS movement. We try to take this complex, sort of nuanced position that it's your right to do it. And some people will feel morally and ethically that they have to do it. We will disagree, but we're also gonna defend your constitutional right to do that. And that it's a mistake for the American Jewish establishment. It's a mistake for pro-Israel activists to engage in efforts to pass legislation that criminalizes First Amendment protected activity. This only turns more people against you. It only turns more people against us, against the state of Israel, against the Jewish community. I mean, I think it's the core point that, that Lara is making. We have common cause with progressive communities that are fighting oppression or fighting racism or fighting Islamophobia. All these different important movements, the Jewish community needs to be there in partnership. And if some of them are engaging in this kind of activism, it is their moral and ethical right and constitutional right to do it. And it's a big mistake for us to make this some form of a litmus test, but even worse, to support making it a crime.
This is a comment for both of you, or either of you, from Elias Baumgarten. And I quote it, "My only reason for not supporting BDS is that it includes the demand that Israel allow the right of return and not just compensate Palestinians or Palestinian state, but permit a literal return. I would like to see a BDS movement that explicitly affirms the right of Israel to exist and focuses only on boycotting Israel for its policies." Comments?
Look, I will say to that, I think most people, setting aside the core of the BDS movement, and they can speak for themselves, and you know, I would encourage Partners for Progressive Israel to expand the conversation maybe at some point and include someone who actually is a BDS supporter or leader. Most people I meet on a daily basis, essentially that is what they are supporting. What Elias has just written there is what most people support. They're saying, you know what? We got to do something. It's what some of the comments said before. Nothing is waking Israel up. Nothing is changing policies. It isn't about ticking off the boxes on the BDS movement website. It's about adopting a tactic that people feel would be impactful. And I have heard, you know, for years, from my years of working at Peace Now, where I was in the heart of the Jewish community and, you know, meeting with synagogues and students, I watched an evolution of Jewish progressives who initially said, I can't bear it. I can't bear the idea of boycotting Israel, who over time came around to, I've had it. I throw up my hands. There's nothing I can do. Obama tries to put pressure on him. They call him an anti-Semite. The U.S. can't touch aid because that's considered anti-Israel and, you know, anathema to our own security interests. What in the world can we do? The U.N. takes action. It's considered diplomatic terror. There's a certain point when people say, fine, we will boycott. I think most people who are boycotting, that is what they're doing. And as far as it goes for Palestinians who are boycotting, I'm going to suggest that we as Jews who for thousands of years in exile said next year in Jerusalem and never gave up our hope to have our homeland, I think it's a lot of chutzpah in calling on other people to give up the dream. I don't think they're going to get it. And I hope that if we ever get to two states, they will see that as a good, you know, it's not perfect justice, but it allows people to move forward. But I'm not going to ask people as sort of like a chip for us to stand together against things we agree are wrong to first give up their narrative, their dream, their identity. I don't think it's right.
Question for both of you from Meg Palmer. How do you perceive the evangelical Christian right support for anti-BDS laws? You spoke to this a bit before in general.
This brings you back to the politics of Israel in the moment. I mean, I think it is very critical to understand that for the Netanyahu world, for the right of center, let's say the David Friedman style of pro-Israel politics, the evangelical community is the absolute key political base from which to work in the generations to come. You know, their understanding is correct, which is that there are 60 million evangelical Christians as opposed to 6 million Jews, and 80 to 90% of the evangelicals agree with the right wing, and 70 to 80% of the Jews disagree with the right wing. So they're going to find a better political base in that part of the country. And it is now becoming an issue that is kind of like choice. It is kind of like guns. It is not necessarily a rational policy debate about how do you resolve a conflict. It is more of a question of faith and belief. And, you know, are you, you know, part of our faith structure and worldview or not? And, you know, I think that the play that the Pompeos and the Pences and the Nikki Haley's are making, and, you know, I think to some extent the Netanyahu-Dermer world is right alongside with them, they are just going to feed their right of center evangelical base and make this a core issue of the Republican Party, which, of course, you know, won the 2016 presidency. So in their view, they chose the right side. They're continuing to go all in on that side. I think this is terrible for the state of Israel. As somebody who loves the state of Israel and wants to see it have a relationship with the United States going forward and wants there to be broad-based support for Israel, I think it's a big mistake to take your chips and put it all on one side of the table. You know, I think that there's a, you know, going to be a reckoning and there's going to be a pendulum swing. And you see the politics shift already in 2018 in the House. You know, look ahead and you see what can happen in the 2020s. Demographically, this country is moving away from that as the core base of the country and the core of political power. And so, you know, I think it's a huge strategic mistake for the state of Israel and for pro-Israel advocates to put their chips on the table in that space.
And if I could just add, it underscores the values contradiction here. There's a cognitive dissonance that should be plaguing progressives when they deal with BDS. The BDS legislation at the state level is being carried in a lot of states by ALEC. You would think the progressives would be immediately...
Oh, what's ALEC? Yeah.
And ALEC you can Google it and learn all about it. I will describe it simply as a very, very powerful political force of the right, which works at a national level with enormous effectiveness to push draft legislation on a range of very conservative issues or conservative viewpoints. And ALEC has made BDS legislation one of those things that it's pushing. The American Center for Law and Justice is pushing a lot of this kind of stuff. Spend some time on the website of the American Center for Law and Justice. This is Jay Sekulow, this is President Trump's lawyer for the Russia probe. You may think that's wonderful. As a Jew, you may be thrilled that the president's messianic Jewish lawyer is taking up the cause of killing the PLO and shutting down funding for UNRWA and fighting BDS legislation. I would suggest that if you're really progressive, it might make you wonder if there's something wrong with the position you're taking, because that's a weird person for you to be standing side by side with on this. And this is a moment, this week, I don't know what day it is, the Yesha Council is in town, the settlers are in town for AIPAC, and they're having their big reception at the Bible Museum, which is the Evangelical Bible Museum. It's not for nothing that they're having their big reception at the Bible Museum. They are more comfortable surrounded by evangelicals who are praying every day for Jews to die in a pool of fire than they are with progressives who care about Israel being a democratic state.
Okay. Thank you. A couple of questions about Jerusalem for both of you. First is anonymous. There are parts of Jerusalem such as Gilo, Neve Yaakov, French Hill, Ramot, and the Old City, which are beyond the Green Line. Do you consider them to be settlements which should be boycotted?
So since I'm the one who advocates settlement boycott, I will take that question. It's not a matter of what I consider a settlement. It's the matter of what defines a settlement. And settlement is, viewed obviously in our political lexicon for most of us as a pejorative term. I come from a policy wonk State Department background, and settlement is a technical term, and it means nothing more than an Israeli civilian population center established across the armistice line. Whether that means it's someday going to have to be moved or whether it can stay, that is a political question, but defining it is based on where it is. And that matters, because as soon as you start playing with that definition, if you say, well, but this isn't really a settlement because everybody knows, at that point you're basically saying that the 1949 armistice line is not the basis for negotiations, at which point you can throw Oslo and Land for Peace out the window, which, maybe we're on the verge of doing that anyway. But that's the term. As far as being boycotted, it's one of those fun, I've gotten this question before as a sort of gotcha question. And it's a fun gotcha question because, like, okay, so are you saying boycott Jerusalem? I would defy you to go spend some time in Gilo, Neve Yaakov, French Hill, Ramot, and the Old City and demonstrate how much production is coming out of there that we can call for people to boycott. It would be my view that if you are calling for boycotting settlements, that includes the industrial zone that is the edge of Atarot. It includes, if Neve Yaakov starts having a vibrant international industry of handmade yarmulkes, Neve Yaakov is largely ultra-Orthodox, then yes, that would fall under settlement boycott, absolutely, if you're calling for settlement boycott.
And the only thing I would just add, since, as Mara indicated, we are not an advocate of settlement boycott, so I'm not answering the question from that perspective. The gotcha aspect of this question, of course, is from people who don't support two states. At the end of the day, if there is to be a two-state solution, then all of those neighborhoods, Gilo, Neve Yaakov, French Hill, Ramot, will be part of the state of Israel. There's no question about that. but it is always the agenda of anonymous attendees at the BDS discussions like this to try to catch you on that. And we're not saying, nobody who's in favor of two states saying that these neighborhoods aren't going to be, but I also would say back to anonymous that, you know, you don't really probably want Shu'afat and Isawiya and some of the other Atur neighborhoods of Jerusalem that are, you know, a couple hundred thousand Palestinians that right now, in fact, some of them are outside the security barrier, even though they are technically part of the eternal unified capital of the Jewish people and are residents of Jerusalem under technical terms. But the security barrier was built to keep them out of the city of which they are a resident. So these issues are a lot more complex than can be, you know, quickly gotcha'd in these kinds of conversations. And if you really want to end the conflict, then the answer is that those neighborhoods will be part of the state of Israel and the Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem will be part of the state of Palestine. And we will have a capital for a state of Palestine that is in East Jerusalem. And we will have the capital of the state of Israel in West Jerusalem. And the United States will have an embassy in West Jerusalem to the state of Israel and an embassy in East Jerusalem to the state of Palestine. So if you really want to end this conflict and stop the bloodshed and stop the violence and stop the debate about BDS, then let's start talking about how we get to an actual viable end of conflict resolution.
One final question from Jonathan Kopp. What's the answer to the charge that non-Palestinians who selectively protest Israel over human and civil rights in the occupied territories expose their anti-Semitism by not also protesting other countries for similar or worse violations?
So I'll go first. You know, I've got friends. I have a friend who has spent the last 20 years of her life campaigning to prevent abuse of elephants. She does not campaign to prevent the abuse of every single animal in the world. She feels a particular affinity and affinity with and concern for elephants. Does that make her somehow anti-circus specifically? Or does it mean that she somehow is a hypocrite because she isn't worrying also about endangered fill in the blank? You know, this is one of those, again, gotcha questions. I care about things all over the world. I'm human. I personally care about this especially. And by the way, not the fact that I'm Jewish, I don't think gives me special permission. For people who want to say, well, what about? I get the what about. Why don't you care about this? I do care about that. This is where I'm choosing to put my energy. That is my choice. It is not anti-Semitic. It is not anti-Israel. It is pro-human rights. It is pro-progressive values. It's consistent with what I believe. Does that mean there are no anti-Semites involved in activism against Israel? Certainly not. Doesn't mean there's no anti-circus people involved in activism in favor of elephants. Certainly not. Does that mean that activism in this area should be thrown out? You can't do it? Come on. Really.
I've never heard that argument. I'll have to remember that that analogy, Lara. That's a great one. Thank you.
It's true, too.
Yeah.
Jeremy, you want to add anything?
No, I'm going to like live on that metaphor now for quite a few years. So.
Beautiful.
Jonathan, thanks you, too. Because I'm sure in New York and Brooklyn, he gets a lot of that particular line of questioning.
Would the two of you each like to take a minute to say something you haven't said yet?
I mean, I can talk about this issue for more than a minute. That's the problem. If you let me get started. I am very grateful that we are having this conversation. I'm grateful, you know, Jeremy is optimistic, and I hope to hope some of that optimism comes over to my office. I don't feel it right now about the Democratic Party. I tend to think that this is going to get worse before it gets better. But one of the things that makes me feel it's getting better is I have been shouting hair on fire for 5 years about the legislation, about the conflation, and I couldn't get anyone to care. I have, you know, articles and tables of data. And it feels like we have reached a tipping point where people are waking up and they're recognizing, whether it's because you care about human rights, international law, civil liberties, if folks don't wake up now, it's going to be too late. And I feel like we actually are having that tipping point. And a conversation like this is a sign of that. So that does give me a little bit of optimism. And for that, I thank you.
Jeremy?
And so, you know, my only message is to, you know, the handful of people that I happen to know on this call are coming at this from the right, because the other 92 people I know personally, and they all agree with me anyway. So I'll just say to the three or four folks who I know are trolling us here, you know, the alarm bells that I sound are not necessarily the exact same ones as Laura, but they're similar. I think that it is just so vital for pro-Israel advocates to recognize how late in the game we are to save the state of Israel. That the notion that the greatest problem that we have is a freshman Muslim woman legislator from Minnesota who has a few ill-advised tweets, that somehow is the thing that we need to be rallying about and around and against, when the very core of what it means to be a state of the Jewish people is being eroded in front of our eyes. I ask people to look in the mirror and ask themselves, what is the true threat to having a vibrant, safe, stable, secure, Jewish and democratic Israel that is there for your children and your grandchildren and is accepted around the world? The only way that that is ever going to happen is to end this occupation, to ensure that there is a state for the Palestinian people, and to do everything we can to make sure that state is a success so that the neighborhood can grow and the neighborhood can change. That's what our agenda has to be. Instead of fighting this silly fight over tweets and a silly fight against a few folks on college campuses and in food co-ops who want to boycott hummus and wine, I just think people have to take a real look in the mirror and check their priorities about what's important to fight for.
Well, thank you both for helping to reject silliness, and we're done for the day. But the conversation will go on, and I thank all of you for tuning in. I want to thank our panelists and also the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their non-silly work. Exactly. You can go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about us and the programs. And thank you, and goodbye.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Thank you to Partners. Yeah, thank you very much. A great call.